Hello, everybody. It's Saturday, January 4th, 2020, and we're all gathered here today for our Bible study. And we are recording from the Plainfield Christian Science Church Independent, Plainfield, New Jersey, the United States of America, and we welcome you all in. And this morning, we have Mike as our moderator.
Thank you, and good morning. So I shall read the quote. Nehemiah, being the last of the prophets, was called by the Jews, quote, the seal of the prophets, unquote. How beautifully this applies to our teacher. She is to us the seal of the discoverers of truth. Jesus came and demonstrated how the truth was to make man perfect right here. The object of his life work after a few centuries seemed to have been lost. And only a glimmer of light was seen here and there until one was brought forth who rediscovered the glorious and infinitely perfect significance of our Master's life work. She has realized for us all how he was most truly, quote, the way, the truth, and the life, unquote. She first realized for herself how glorious it was to be free through the truth from the bondage of materiality. Then she set herself to the task of rebuilding the walls of the new Jerusalem. We have been called to help her in this glorious and yet solemn task. The tumult of the enemy is heard in our camps. She orders us to put on our armor and to stand ready to use our swords, but not discontinue the work. She says to us with Paul, quote, take unto ourselves the whole armor of God, that we may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand, unquote. After trying all sorts of devices to hinder the work, our enemies now try to make her come down from the wall onto their plane or level through malicious animal magnetism. But we can all hear her saying in most emphatic tones, quote, I am doing a great work, so I cannot come down. Why should the work cease, whilst I leave it and come down to you, unquote. Can we not see that it is impossible for Nehemiah to come down? And this was from the rebuilding by Nehemiah the Wall of Jerusalem from the Christian Science Journal of September 1889 and written by Annie F. Colt, C.S.
Interesting. Yeah,
thank
you.
That was wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. Do we have that on our website? We should put that on our website. That article is probably, the whole thing is probably wonderful. And, you know, this is the battle call. This is what should always be going on. Never should have stopped. Tool in one hand working and a weapon in the other. And this story of the building of the wall was one that was taught often in this church during the law case, because the lessons in it were things that we had to apply to ourselves individually and collectively. And as was the story of Gideon's band, two very important, helpful, instructive biblical stories. And it holds true for today now. It's very sad that the Bible stories, people say they're no longer relevant. Well, maybe if you're not doing anything for God, they're no longer relevant. But when you are, they are extremely relevant and life-saving instruction.
And in reality, anybody who isn't doing anything for God isn't living anyway. I mean, God put us here to do something useful.
Absolutely.
So it is indeed relevant to all of us. But it's a lesson in handling animal magnetism, isn't it?
Sure. It seems to be a continuum. It's like from history to now, it's the same liar always trying to, you know, discourage and so on. So it continues, and we have to continue to stand. That's it.
Yeah, there's always going to be something to try to distract you, me, us, doing what God has for us to do.
And in meeting these distractions, it only makes us stronger in God's work.
And if you always see it, no matter what is going on, if you always see it as an attack on your work for God and impersonalize it, that's how you handle it. And that is what will keep you going, because it comes as personal problems. It will come as some personal thing. And then if you take it personally and think you're having this personal unhealed problem, it'll just flip you out. If you see it as something coming to stop the work, and you handle it impersonally and saying that the H, you say, I'm not stopping my work for God, it will disappear, diminish, and or disappear into its native nothingness. We here have proved this over and over again. And it's why we're here. It's also why there are so few here. Because when it comes, it roars like a lion. I mean, through the law case, all the things that were thrown at us mentally, physically, emotionally, and, you know, we could, oh, this doesn't really have anything to do with the law case or anything else. This is just horrible. Our little two-year-old granddaughter now say, this is horrible. And that's about it. It's horrible. So impersonalize it. And those of us left standing were able to do it in some miraculous way, which is why we're, and it's the only reason why we're still here, because it just flips you out so fast and so hard. And you look at what it did to Mrs. Eddy. My goodness, her whole family was removed from her, her children, her one child, her mother, everything she loved, her husband, and then everybody deserted her. She had one thing after the next. And that's why when anyone complains about what's coming at them, I just say, well, look what happened to her. Look what happened to Christ Jesus. We just better put a finger over our lip, put our heads down, and just keep walking. Because it's nothing compared to what others, especially those two, suffered.
So stop your belly ache.
Yes, my father used to tell me that often.
But and after she lost so much, after so much was removed from her, who was it who was telling her to come down off the wall? It was her sister. It was her students. It was family, friends, so-called. It was the people closest to her. And that's how it is for us. It will be the people closest to us who will try to keep us from answering God's call to do what he has for us to do.
And watch his prayers, arguments. Mrs. Eddy says, this is not my pain or error. This is an attack on my Christ. And that is so helpful to make you realize it's not personal.
Thank you. Absolutely. Whether it calls itself pain, whether it calls itself relationship problems, other types of physical problems, financial problems, impersonalize it and keep going. Wouldn't Era like to have us all just flipped out and nobody left to do the work? It'll come right before, people have told me, it'll come before you have a watch to do. Phones will ring, people will come over, you're suddenly not feeling well, your family needs help with something, all your pipes break in the house. I mean, you know, you name it, it'll happen.
Your son starts screaming at you.
Yeah, your son starts screaming at you. Mm-hmm. Impersonalize it. It's coming tailor-made to you, to get you to stop this work. And if you don't, the problem will disappear, because that's the only purpose. What does Mrs. Eddy say? Era is neither what? Or it's not.
Neither person, place, nor thing.
Yes. remember, it might wear a face, it might seem like a place, or it might seem like a thing, but it is always behind the mask is animal magnetism.
It's like the Wizard of Oz. Puts on a good front, but there's nothing behind it.
Yeah, it's just a little man hiding behind a screen or something. Who was just poofing and puffing and getting everyone thinking it was something real and horrible. This has been the secret to the success of our church. It's because we've been able to do this. We were trained to do it many years ago. And it's just that simple. It's a matter of doing it, because you might be able to listen to this rationally now, but then something gets thrown at you and you think it's real and awful and horrible and whatever it is. If you don't impersonalize it, you'll think it'll take you out in some way. And you know what? It will. Unless you stand up to it and say, I know who and what you are, and I'm not budging. My face is set like a flint. Yes. Toward Jerusalem.
And I have to say, we have had the benefit of those that have gone before us. The early directors of the Mother Church. We've been able to see what mistakes they've made and hopefully learn from them so as not to make the same mistakes.
And you see this wonderful article written in 1889. Mrs. Eddy was still here. How many people have read this? Nobody, except Mike. Well, now we'll have it online, and this is what our liberator has been about too. Because for years, Mrs. Evans, was culling out these wonderful articles from the old journals and sentinels, in many cases rewriting them, mainly because they were so long, you know, 4 or 5 pages. And now we have continued that work, mainly Carol. To keep these truths, to resurrect them from the graveyard where they've been buried in the reading rooms, which no one goes to anymore. You know what I'm saying? So we will resurrect these articles, put new life, raise up the dry bones.
The phoenix shall rise from the ashes.
Yes. And put this new renewed life into them. And so we learn from these wonderful early workers.
I have to make a comment on that. What I did was I did a search on the ark for Nehemiah, and there were several articles that were after 1910, and none of them said anything really. And my practitioner was having me read some things from Bicknell Young, and I believe it was the 1936 association address. He made the comment that there wasn't enough metaphysics in the current of 1936, the current journals and sentinels, that had enough metaphysics to really be effective for most Christian Scientists, to be helpful for them.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yep. Why we only go back to the early times. They got watered down and watered down and watered down. They lost their thrust. Even if the words are flowery and nice, they didn't have the power behind it, in many cases, because it was not being lived.
So, Mike, maybe just for the benefit of people who were not familiar with it, I'm not very familiar with it, but just let people know who are listening, you know, in on this is, What is the ark? Might be useful for people to know.
The ark is a, how do I put it? It's a collection from Longyear that has all the Journal and Sentinels up until, I think, about 1920. And it also has, I mean, it has many, many things, old lessons, and also has the Bible on it. And I think at the time it was about $400, if anybody's interested, but you can go to Longyear and the site, and it was just, at that time, it was the least expensive program that I could find, because I wasn't sure at that time that I was going to be able to get the bound volumes, and they'd so enamored me, and I really wasn't interested in anything recent anyway, so it was fine.
Thank you, and thank you for the question, Tom. I didn't know what it was either, although I probably have heard.
Well, I think it looks fascinating, so a lot of information there that can be accessed digitally, so that's pretty cool, I think.
Well, the thing, too, that I do have to comment about it is that the search isn't the most efficient, so it gives us a way of listening to God, I guess, of trying different combinations, and then things come up, and it's got like three headings. You can search or not search the Bible, Mrs. Eddy's works, which would be all of the official works, so prose works, Science and Health, with, you know, the scriptures and the manual and such, and then the periodicals, and you can kind of cut down on, you know, have less hits if you, you know, decide to, like in this case, I went to the periodicals.
So it's like a concordance to all of those things.
Thank you. That's exactly what it is. It's not only a concordance, but it also, then you can find, you can directly go, and then you can email and print and whatever you want to do off of it.
And it costs $400?
I believe that's what I believe it was at the time.
Hmm. So is it online or is it a DVD?
Well, actually, it's both. If it's online, you can get a password and et cetera. You type in, you know, whatever, username, password, but you also get a little flash drive. So if you're in a place where there isn't any internet access, you can still do your search. I guess everything's on that flash drive.
That's wonderful.
Amazing.
I think I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and it's actually interesting because I did talk to Longyear about it, and they do allow you to share it with people.
I'm not sure that it's Longyear who put it together, because it does say that Ark Publication LLC is not affiliated with the First Church of Christ Scientists in Boston, Massachusetts, or the Christian Science Publishing Society. So I'm not sure if they're selling it through Longyear or not, but it does say clearly that it is not affiliated with Boston.
Well, it is a little confusing. I mean, it says that you're right, and it says also you can purchase it from Biblos Foundation and Longyear Museum, but those links are broken, so I'm not sure what this means. Anyway. It's kind of interesting.
Well, thank you for explaining what the ark is.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, are there any other comments? Well, thank you for that question. It didn't even occur to me that that might be an issue. Any other comments about the quote or anything, or shall we go on?
I think we can go on.
Okay. So the topic is Nehemiah and God's governance. Bible readings were Nehemiah chapters 1 through 13. And the first question, I think we'll break this down. Who is Nehemiah and what was his relationship to Artaxerxes, hopefully I said that right, Sanballat, Tobiah, Eliashib, and Ezra? So who was Nehemiah?
He was a Jew who was the cupbearer to the king. And I looked up what a cupbearer was, because when we previously had done Nehemiah, I thought it was kind of a lame position. But it turns out that on account of constant fear of plots and intrigues, a person must be regarded as thoroughly trustworthy to hold the position. He must guard against poison in the king's cup, and was sometimes required to swallow some of the drink before serving it. His confidential relations with the king often gave him a position of great influence.
Thank you.
Sounds like a very solemn position, and one that has to be earned, which says incredible things about Nehemiah. And here he was, basically a servant. But he earned that position?
It had to be a very trusted relationship, because when he asked him, the king, to go, it sounds like both him and his wife were upset. They were wondering when he's going to come back and all that. So he must have really meant a lot to them. I mean, whoever would taste the wine before he gives it to the king, that meant something. I mean, I think in other places it's like so that if there's any poison in it, then it won't get to the king. So that position meant a lot.
That probably also gave him great skill in being very watchful and alert to any intrigue, which gives me a new insight into his ability, preparing him for what he had to do later.
Yeah, that's a good point. He has to protect the king.
Yeah.
Knowing that there are people out to get the king.
He was, even it would advise the king at times too. That's how trustworthy acted as a bodyguard. And I find it interesting, because I didn't really realize this, but I've since learned that our presidents have someone like...
They have tasters.
They have tasters, bodyguards. And they have to be very, very trusted to be around the president. It's highly important.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Okay.
Matthew Henry made a comment about, I thought was interesting. He said, God has his remnant in all places and can make the courts of princes sometimes nurseries, and sometimes sanctuaries to the friends and patrons of the church's cause.
It's beautiful.
That was it.
Yes.
Yep, in all places. In fact, Mary just informed me this morning that our newest member, I don't know if we should announce this or not.
Yes, we will. Absolutely.
It's Napoleon, who is translating some of our articles and watching points into
Hindi, Punjabi, and Urdu.
Wonderful. For places in the Middle East that most people can't ever get to.
Now think of the import of that. Our first member from Pakistan, and he's a member because he's been translating, and it's the words have converted him. They have convinced him of the truth. And you see, this is the leaven of truth operating. So we hear all of this right now about Iran, Iraq, all of these places. Well, our church word is there getting out, and it is the leaven of truth. And what is reported and what is actually going on are often two very different things. And we put on noteworthy news recently how a lot of these probable leaders are turning people to Christianity, because many of them have promised their nation so much, and the nation has become much worse. And so people are turning by the droves to Christianity. So what might seem like something disastrous, God is still there working his purpose out. So we now have, as far as I know, our first Pakistani member, and he was converted to Christian Science by just reading it and taking it in. And we have on our bulletin board this beautiful, dear picture his daughter Olive drew, Christmas card. He's a very dear, sweet man. And so the work is going on. And you see, unfettered by ecclesiastical despotism, our church can go out freely to all mankind without all this. Well, should we do it? We can't do it. We can't. Maybe we'll have to think about it. No, we just do it. If God says it, we do it. And it's reaching its mark. And we pray and support this missionary work. We can't really send people out there, but our website goes out there.
And he certainly faced challenges this past year. So he's learned to deal with it too.
Yeah. I mean, he lives in a country where it's dangerous to be Christian. God bless him.
And yes, and we must do this work. And you see, this is what we're going to get into, watching day and night. So, yeah, we'll be announcing this over and over in the next few weeks.
Okay, so that's his relationship to Artaxerxes.
I wanted to just make a couple of points. Nehemiah, according to Strong's definition, is consolation of Jah, or comfort of Jah, which is God. And 1828 Webster says consolation is very fitting. The definition is alleviation of misery or distress of mind, refreshment of mind or spirits. And it supports and strengthens the mind with hope, joy, courage, and the like, and brings it to God. And then Smith's Bible Dictionary, under History of the Books of the Bible, says, Nehemiah presents a noble example of true patriotism, founded on the reverence of God, seeking the really religious welfare of the state. His respect for the divine law, his reverence for the Sabbath, his devout acknowledgement of God in all things, his practical perception of God's character, his union, watchfulness and prayer, his humility in ascribing all good himself to the grace of God are all highly commendable. Few books indeed of the Bible contain a richer illumination of divine philosophy, that is, of true religion taught by example.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a wonderful example of true leadership, Nehemiah.
And I think it's very striking what you just said about the new member, because Nehemiah was also part of the captivity that was left in this case, it was remaining in Persia. And I mean, it's just fascinating to me how reverent he was in trying to enable and rebuild Jerusalem and the Word of God. Anything else on him specifically, or shall we go to, we have the relationship, anything else on Artaxerxes? Not, what was, who was Sanballat, and what was the relationship between him and Nehemiah?
I think a good word would be the opposition.
Well, they were regional governors serving under the king. And I think Sanballat was maybe a Samaritan.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think he was the governor of the region where Jerusalem was, right? And he did not, he was not fond of the Jews.
You know, it shows the prayerful work that was done by Nehemiah to have the king sympathetic to him. He was, of course, very trustworthy, yes, but he was also sympathetic, wasn't he? Let him go and build the wall. And he...
let him have timber from his forest.
Yes, yeah, he was.
Well, he even just realized that Nehemiah was sad.
He did. And I read where that was unlawful to go before the king with a sad countenance. You had to be, you know, all cheerful if you were going to be around the king. So, yeah. But you see, when you were in the right mind, you were doing the right thing, and your prayer is unselfish and unceasing, it will change the environment around you. Even where you could have a king who could be off with your head, it wasn't that way at all with this. That's true with Ezra as well. So, yes, but then you have these regional governors, thank you, Elizabeth, who did not like him. And they were, thank you, Betty, the opposition.
And I think, you know, it was envy and jealousy partly that motivated them.
Yes.
I think that's such a key, because every time I had read it, I didn't realize that they were actually serving the same king. And Persian Empire ranged from Indus River, I think, not quite into India, but from the border of India all the way to Libya, and then definitely both Jerusalem and Samaria were part of that empire. So they should have been on the same side of the fence. They shouldn't have been fighting each other.
I think fighting was a way of life in those days.
Unfortunately, in these days also.
Yeah, evidently, I guess it's a reoccurring.
It's the human mind.
Human mind.
So anyway, that explains why Nehemiah went around and inspected the damage at night, but he was awake. Because he knew that Sanballat and others were not going to be happy about fixing Jerusalem.
One fascinating thing I found online was that Sanballat means sin has begotten, and sin was the moon god that any of those outside of the Jewish population worship.
Yeah, I read his name meant enemy in secret. And also, I guess it was Tobias that he had taken over the storerooms of the temple for his own use. So obviously they were doing things, you know, for their own purposes to the temple there. So, I mean, we'll get into more detail as we go on as to what these people did and why. But anybody else on this?
Well, I wanted to mention, I'm going to go out on a limb, but this made me really think about Mrs. Eddy's church, because it really was burned down after she left. And in this, I found that the temple had been rebuilt, but they never rebuilt the wall. And the wall was the fortification. And without the wall, corruption and all these problems were just flowing in and out. And so by building this wall, to me, it's like what the church is doing here at Plainfield, independent, teaching how to handle animal magnetism and building that wall and fortifying. But the interesting thing is, it wasn't until chapter 13, the last chapter, that actually he went in as, I mean, he was rebuking, purifying, and cleansing all throughout. But he went in then to the temple and had it cleaned out and cleansed very thoroughly. And, you know, there's always this talk, you know, about trying to keep this Boston model. But to me, this is a indication that, you know, the cleansing, you have to rebuild the wall and the cleansing then takes place. And the people that weren't fit, he even says somewhere, and I don't have the quote now in front of me, but if they weren't going to be fit, they weren't going to stay.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting because we still get things like, well, you know, why separated? We separated ourselves. Excuse me, we were excommunicated. Please remember this. I mean, we got to work within. We got to build it up from within. We were excommunicated. Remember that, all right? We did not separate ourselves from them. They kicked us out.
We did not seek this.
We didn't. And it's the greatest thing that ever could have happened to us. But for all those people who keep bringing that up, oh, it's terrible, terrible. We should, you know, be all one body. Well, yeah, we should. If we weren't excommunicated, maybe we would have been able to have done something differently. But no. So that being the case, and I also read something very interesting in 400 Beacon Street, which is a big book about the 3 years Mrs. Eddy stayed at Chestnut Hill. And we know that there were two of her secretaries at Chestnut Hill who were on the board of directors later on that
during the litigation
who kicked Eustace out and who, you know, supported
who took over the independent trust for the publishing that Mrs. Eddy set up in violation of what Mrs. Eddy set up for the independence of the publishing.
One of them was Adam Dickey, and one of them was William Rathbone. Now, in reading this, and I never read this before, when Adam Dickey first came to work at Mrs. Eddy's home, he was originally sent home and said, there's no way he could ever work in Mrs. Eddy's home. It would take years before.
To train him properly.
But then he was asked to come back. Now, William Rathbone, so far I haven't read much about, but it also said that the two of them were considered what they call the new guard because neither one of them had been taught by Mrs. Eddy. All the rest had been. Calvin Fry, you know, all that worked in her home. They'd all been taught by Mrs. Eddy. Adam Dickey and William Rathbone had not. And then also, Jeremy, what was the story that you were going to share about this?
The lady that gave us the tour of Chestnut Hill, she passed on a lot of stories while we were there. And one of the things she said was that Calvin Fry had to talk to Adam Dickey and William Rathbone and tell them that there is no difference between what is good for Mrs. Eddy and what is good for the cause of Christian Science. And Adam Dickey and William Rathbone thought that was wrong, that there could not be, that it couldn't be the same.
That it wasn't one and the same. This speaks volumes to me about their personal sense of Mrs. Eddy and why things started to go downward. And she probably knew about Adam Dickey. I don't know what it was that she changed her mind, but it was clearly stated. She said it would take years before he was ready. I think the male chauvinism, the male, you know, I know more than this little woman does. And it started there. And so it has continued. But it's good to know these things because we can be wiser for it.
So might be helpful, I think interesting, that in that huge writing that William Lyman Johnson did on the history of Christian Science, buried somewhere in there, is about how people were trying to find a new way of healing and dispensing with what they had been taught earlier.
Thank you. Yes. And thus came up with New Age.
That's why Mrs. Eddy warns in the textbook that if anybody tries to climb the hill any other way, they will fail. That there is only one way to practice Christian Science.
And they're a thief.
They're a thief, yes.
And they are a thief if they try.
That was a wonderful presentation that Linda gave. And what happened in chapter 13 of Nehemiah was that he'd actually been gone for 12 years. And he came back and had found all this backsliding. So when he had left, obviously Tobiah wasn't living in the storehouse of the temple. But there was this whole thing about the directors and such. I think this is a perfect place to discuss who Eliashib was and his relationship to all these people. I can do a little bit on that, and people can fill in. Eliashib was the high priest, and one of his grandchildren was married to Sanballat's offspring, and he was actually the one that allowed, he actually gave the storehouse for Tobiah's use. So, in other words,
yeah, I read where he had indulged Tobias, but that is the way. Thank you.
Right. And so, in other words, here was the high priest of Jerusalem, basically in cahoots with the people that were trying to prevent Jerusalem from being rebuilt and becoming the glory that it had been.
Thank you. I don't think I want
to.
Yeah. Anyone else have anything more on him?
Well, he went astray because in chapter 3 it says Eliashib the high priest and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. So something happened to him that he, well, it's probably because he became related to them. And he allowed this in. He went astray.
Thank you. As did so many. It's the pressure of animal magnetism. That's why you have to have your face set like a flint.
Yeah. And here's family again. I'm sorry. There's family comes up again.
Yeah, family relationship. Yep. Protect your family.
He had an important position in the organization. And he let family influence overrule God's influence.
So animal magnetism in the form of family relationships. So.
Yes.
Yep. But. Yeah. And he was probably doing it to quote, keep the peace, right? Didn't want to rock the boat.
Well, either that or he was doing it to make money off of the situation.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's usually one or the other.
Or both.
Or both.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure it was both because, I mean, this is what fascinates me is that actually, in one sense, Eliashib should have been above Nehemiah being the high priest. But the fascinating thing is that Nehemiah had the backing of the king of Persia, so that really helped out in the situation.
Yeah, that's why people in, you know, government that get in high positions and give their children so-called positions that they're making millions of dollars on, it's not good.
So I just want to mention how significant the backing was, because Nehemiah was also given access to the king's forest for timber. That's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's our supply, if you think about it. No?
It did kind of make... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing.
Okay. I did kind of make a mistake because... Right at the end, I was trying to figure out how Ezra was involved, because he does get mentioned in Nehemiah, but it turned out that that's a very important part of the story, because what happened was that when the Persians took over from the Babylonians, three kings, and Xerxes was one of them, and the two previous, his probably grandfather and father, they were very, very favorable to the Jews, and they actually let them go back. Anybody who wanted to could go back to Jerusalem, and I can't remember which one, but actually paid to have the temple rebuilt. So they were very, very, kings of Persia were very, very favorable to the Jews. And that makes it really fascinating that it took kind of an outsider, Nehemiah, to come in and really, in the correct way of getting this enforced, because Eliashib could have been in a position to do the same thing, being the high priest.
Yeah, I read that Artaxerxes sent Ezra to Jerusalem to teach the laws of God to anyone who didn't know them, which is really significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, yes. And Ezra, I read it, Nehemiah built the wall, but Ezra restored the worship back to where it should be, encouraging the Jews to banish their foreign wives and get rid of their false idols. So it's a great work being done there. Had to be cleansed and rebuilt, as Linda said.
Had to drain the swamp.
Yeah, right. Had to get rid of all the garbage, yes. It has to be done. Corruption grows. We see it. And the things that I see now, because of what we went through the law case, has changed me incredibly. I was a goody two-shoes and only saw good everywhere and wanted good to be everywhere. Well, I had to learn the workings of animal magnetism and be thrown to the mat, I can't tell you how many times, and realize what this is about. We're not playing, Mrs. Eddie Evans used to love to say, we're not playing tiddlywinks at the manhole covers. Yes, you love to say that. This is serious business, and it's changed me, and I'm beginning to see things I wouldn't ordinarily see everywhere. So we all want everything to be beautiful and lovely as a Christian Scientist, and it is in truth, but we have to be willing to see what needs to be annihilated, not as anything real or true.
Or personal,
but as a false concept, an aggressive mental suggestion. And you can't be nice to it, or it will eat you alive.
We had to find out what was behind what was going on.
Yes.
And that was something that was very difficult for me as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And see what's behind it, what's causing it, what's the motive.
So it was a tremendous experience, as difficult as it was. But that's why you embrace your difficult situations. If you embrace them and know they will bless you, you will learn things. No other way could you learn them. Sometimes the tougher the situation, the greater the lessons. So don't ever despair over tough situations. Learn what lessons are here for you to learn to draw you closer to the Father. And it's stupendous. It's wonderful.
No, it can only do me good.
Yes.
Yeah, because there's no reason to ever get discouraged or give up, because God does not allow any problems in your experience that you're not capable of dealing with.
You wouldn't have the problem if you couldn't meet it. Now, we should probably move on, unless we're going to make this into two or three or four Bible studies.
I just wanted to say one quick thing about Ezra. According to the Smith's Bible Dictionary, he was a scribe and a priest, and he actually took the Bibles of that time and worked on them. In his work, he was assisted by the same spirit, capitalized, by which they were first written. So in other words, he took out the mistakes and rewrote them to where they were supposed to be originally.
Good.
Okay.
was inspired.
So, question number two. Who opposes Nehemiah's rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem? And what methods does the opposition use? And how does Nehemiah overcome this opposition through the spiritual realm? And there is a bunch of different ones that were kind of listed. But if anybody has any favorites that they or questions on any of them, they or feel free to name one, and we can start with that.
Well, we can take them. I mean, they're very important because, as we talked about originally, the workings of animal magnetism. The first were where Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem. What is this thing that you were doing? Will you rebel against the king? What is that?
It's a form of belittling and ridicule. You know, it's making you feel like, you know, you're so stupid. What are you doing up there? What do you? It's. I think the strongest thing to me is to make your purpose something not worthwhile. To really bring it down. What is this that you're doing?
Thank you.
You crazy? You know.
Yes, like
this
they
is
did to
another
Noah.
Another form of thought crime, isn't it? Imputing to him a motive that is true of themselves.
Thank you.
Right?
Scorning, belittling, yes. Now, in certainly that happened to us during the law case. What the heck are you, little church, what are you doing? Just shut up and sit down.
Right. We were renegades. We didn't know the science. Couldn't call ourselves Christian scientists. Hello.
And at the time, it was horrible. I quote Amy, was horrible. Anyway, it did seem very fearsome and horrible. Yes, and you know, you begin to wonder, second guess yourself, or you know, you've got to. Mrs. Evans was always so strong in that truth. Now, I say it can happen collectively, but you can have this happen. Someone can do it to you individually, or you can do it to yourself.
Who am I?
I think the whole thing about using the word rebel against, or the term rebel against the king, I mean, that accuses them, or Nehemiah, as you and Plainfield of being traitors. And that's, you know, so that's really serious stuff. And that's exactly why they're doing it, because it really puts your legs out from under you.
That's exactly right. It's serious stuff. Serious accusation. And remember, go ahead. It can come as a collectively, as a group, as it did to us. It can come where someone tells you individually, what the hell? Why are you a member of this church? What are you doing? What are you? Or it can come as your own thought. What am I doing? What am I doing here?
Jeremy? Also, it's a kind of thing that's difficult to defend against, you know, like Nehemiah had to go the whole distance to show that he was not going against the king, you know, just to say, oh, no, I'm not doing that would not have been enough anyway. So,
well, and he answered because he knew his fact. The God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. He knew his facts. He knew his Bible. He knew his, in our case, our science and health. We know our facts. We go back. What does the Bible say? What are we doing? What are our motives? And stand with that. Bruce?
Absolutely. You know, one of the benefits of this ridicule is it causes us to strengthen our focus. You know, I think we had talked about Noah, who got ridiculed, and it took, what, 40 or 50 years to build his ark?
Yes.
And he withstood the ridicule all those days, and yet he was the one who was saved.
Yes.
So that's one of the tricks of error, to ridicule, belittle, Well, the result of that is it strengthens our focus on what is true.
That's very good. It does. You will be. It's a purification process. When you get hammered like that, you got to really examine yourself. Where are you coming from? What are your motives? And if they are, personal or selfish, or you will get spun out easily, just like Gideon's band. Fewer and fewer were left to do the work.
So this should actually be very encouraging. We've all experienced ridicule. And if you have, be encouraged. You know, you must be doing something well or right. You know, because the devil leaves a dead person alone.
Thank you, yes.
So be encouraged if you're experiencing ridicule. This can be used in a step Godward to make you stronger, purer, and better in what your purpose is.
Thank you.
There's a prayer here when he says in chapter 4, "Hear, this is Nehemiah, hear us, O God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads." That made me think of Mrs. Eddy and what we've learned here. You always turn it back and let God do it.
Yes.
It goes right back on itself.
Yes, it goes back on itself and destroys itself with accelerated force. That's a prayer we've learned to use.
Every day.
Every day. Thank you very much, Shardy. Good point.
And individually, the thoughts that come, oh, you're no good. I don't understand science. I will never, this is too much. You know, you will never be able to do this. It's these little, subtle, wicked thoughts that come. And always what? To turn it back. God didn't see it anyway.
Thank you very much.
And this is a tactic of the human mind because we see it in spades today, don't we?
It is. It is. It's gone on. It'll continue. It's a tactic of the human mind. Yes.
And if you react, then you're dead meat. But if you stay strong, you can't touch it.
That's right. Reaction is the bridge over which animal magnetism comes. So if you react, it shows that there's something in you that, you know, pride or whatever, oh, what are you saying to me, and rah, 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 and you set the battle in array. But Nehemiah was too smart for any of that. He came back strong and hard with, we are servants of God, and this is an important mission, and we will not be deterred from it. And yeah, it goes back on you and will destroy you if you
persist.
Because Nehemiah brought God back into the picture. Now the accusations that come are accusing your own personal inabilities. You don't understand. You're not able. You're just small. Well, if I'm just a little mortal, that may be true. However, there is one who is able. And the one that is able is Almighty God himself. And our position in the whole picture is his servant. Therefore, I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. So I will not listen to these personal accusations about our inabilities, because the one who is able is with us.
Thank you very much. You see how this purifies, and as Bruce says, strengthens you. It turns you more and more to God. That's why, blessed are ye when men shall
revile you.
Yes.
And persecute you.
For my sake.
I like it where Frank Mason has written about Jesus and said that one thing that Jesus never let anything come between him and God.
Right.
I think it's that self-forgetfulness that makes you, allows that you to be godlike. Person out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone, as Bruce mentioned, if you're going to be in this work, it's going to happen. Sooner or later, these things will happen to you if you're really working. as he said, arrow doesn't shoot a dead man.
And it'll probably be sooner.
Probably be sooner, yeah. And most of you have already experienced it. So it's all right. And remember, it's not person, place, or thing. It's just a mask. And behind the mask is animal magnetism. If you handle it like that, you'll be fine. If you see it as your son or your husband or your friend or a certain place you don't like or whatever you think, you've made a reality of it. And you'll continue having the problem till you learn the lesson. Now it's 11 o'clock, and I don't know whether we can finish this in another session. Unless you want to go on and go over time.
Well, we've covered a lot. Any more methods that anybody wants to talk about?
Well, these other methods are important ones. We should go over them, if not today.
I hope we have another Bible study because there's so much.
Okay. All right. Well, let's leave it at that then. Mike, we'll pick it up again in a couple weeks or whenever.
This deserves more than one Bible study. So,
yeah,
figure out something.
Yeah, we just barely scratched the surface.
Just got started
with Nehemiah.
So, thank you very much, Mike.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Can I say one thing real quick here? The point that Shardy brought up is so important because I never noticed that Nehemiah until I heard that being discussed in our roundtables or Bible studies about the error being turned back upon the one spreading it. And then when I saw it in Nehemiah, it's like, oh my gosh, this is worthy of a good Bible study.
Truly, it is.
Absolutely.
So thank you, everybody. Thank you, Plainfield, for all this wonderful information.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.